shrinking number of wealthy and corporate air passengers, Southwest was attracting vast numbers of new customers from groups that had never flown before. College students seeking cheap travel between school and home. Families wanting to take the kids to visit grandma and grandpa. And young couples escaping for romantic getaways. Southwest was opening the skies to a whole new class of air travelers. And it was possible only because the airline was able to operate profitably, even grow, by offering airfares that were often half the price of those demanded by national carriers. Southwest's low fares didn't just attract the attention of travelers. They drew the ire of the major airlines. And who could blame them? While the national carriers were struggling to survive as they coped with the inflexible rules foisted on them by the CAB, Southwest Airlines' success was due almost entirely to the freedom to set its own fares, routes, and schedules. It wasn't a complete free-for-all for Southwest Airlines. The company was still subject to oversight by Texas state agencies and the Federal Aviation Administration. But overall, the regulatory burden was far less restrictive. By comparison, the airline enjoyed the same freedom as, say, the kids in the back row of a crowded school bus with a disinterested driver at the wheel. Unable to compete with Southwest on a level playing field within Texas, three airlines, Braniff, Continental, and Trans-Texas Airways, a regional airline, sued to stop Southwest from flying. But in 1970, the Texas Supreme Court, and later the U.S. Supreme Court, sided with David against the Goliaths. Southwest Airlines could continue flying free from the constraints of federal regulation within its home state. National press coverage of the lengthy legal battle only highlighted Southwest's growing success and raised questions about the need for continued federal airline regulations. Across the country, people wondered why, if such benefits were available to the residents of Texas, they shouldn't be available everywhere else. By the time Jimmy Carter was elected president in 1976, it was clear something had to be done to save the airline industry. Almost immediately, Carter appointed Alfred E. Kahn to head up the CAB. Kahn had no background in aviation and very little in administration. He was an economist and self-described good liberal Democrat. Yet like many other leading progressives of his day, he believed fervently that government regulation was most often bad for consumers. In his book, The Economics of Regulation, he asserted that even very imperfect competition is preferable to regulation. Working with like-minded progressives, including Senator Edward Kennedy and consumer advocate Ralph Nader, Kahn spearheaded the effort to deregulate the airline industry. In effect, he made it his mission to kill the agency he headed. It didn't take long. In little more than a year, the Airline Deregulation Act was passed by Congress and signed into law by President Carter on October 24, 1978. The legislation set forth a plan to remove restrictions on the airlines in phases over a four-year period, with all regulation of domestic fares ending by 1983. In reality, it would all happen much faster. As each phase lifted a new set of regulations, airfares dropped and more passengers booked flights. Almost instantly, airfares fell within reach of ordinary folks who'd never previously considered air travel because of the cost, a group that included middle-class parents wanting to take the kids somewhere warm for spring break. Deregulation wasn't the only reason for the big drop in airfares. Better planes and new technology also played roles. But it can be argued that deregulation created the competitive environment that prompted airlines to find ways to continue reducing costs. Substantially cheaper airfares meant significantly more people taking to the skies. In 1977, just prior to deregulation, 240 million passengers bought tickets for flights. 5 years after the government began lifting restrictions on airlines, 316 million passengers boarded planes, an increase of 31%. 10 years after deregulation began, 89% more passengers booked flights on U.S. airlines. Today, more than three times as many people buy airline tickets as in 1977. Of course, the uptick in air travel wasn't about price alone. It also had to do with route choice. With the government no longer dictating or limiting routes, carriers could offer more service between more places. Prior to deregulation, American Airlines flew to 39 destinations. Today it flies to more than 350, nearly 9 times as many. And that's just one airline. With the airlines free to offer cheaper and faster access to more places, traveling families like mine were ready to trade long drives for short flights. In the early 80s, I had no clue about airline deregulation, of course. I was simply beginning to notice that more of my classmates were returning from holiday breaks with sunburns and shark tooth necklaces. They had better stories to tell, too. Instead of the usual tired recaps of trips to their aunt and uncle's houses in Indianapolis or Cleveland, my buddies were telling tales of climbing to the top of the Statue of Liberty in New York, getting attacked by the giant shark from Jaws on a tour of Universal Studios in Hollywood, and brushing their fingers over real bullet holes in the walls of the Alamo in San Antonio, Texas. I'd listen, engrossed, as they recounted how they stood in the very spot where Davy Crockett fell when he and a band of brave souls attempted to hold off hordes of marauding Mexican troops before meeting their grisly end. This was good stuff. Each of my friends' stories included a detailed description of hurtling down a long runway before lifting off into the sky, being served their choice of tasty meals by a knockout stewardess, and, us being 12 years old and all, paying a visit to a tiny restroom at the rear of the plane with a special toilet that noisily sucked down whatever was deposited in it. Well, within reason. My friends had the goods to back up their stories, too. When assigned to make speeches in class, they brought in the coolest souvenirs to pass around. Real scorpions frozen in glass from Arizona. Boxes of saltwater taffy from the boardwalk in Atlantic City. Colorful seashells and dried starfish from beaches all over Florida. And, of course, gleaming silver airline badges shaped like wings. The last of these were personally pinned to their shirts by the cool pilots of the even cooler jets that had flown them to their destinations. Airplanes, or at least airplane, dominated our daily discussions. For an extended period after the hit comedy's release in 1980, every conversation between us preteens eventually linked back to the movie. Even if we weren't exactly sure why the autopilot was suddenly smiling and enjoying a smoke after being inflated by the winsome Julie Haggerty, one of my friends would inevitably declare that he'd picked the wrong week to give up sniffing glue. It became common to strike up a conversation with a buddy by asking if he enjoyed watching gladiator movies or ever spent a night in a Turkish prison. If you grew up during that time, surely you understand. And yes, I just called you Shirley. If nothing else, the movie kept airplanes buzzing around our thoughts. When the day finally came for me to board my first flight and head to Washington, D.C. with my family in 1981, I was understandably excited. I could hardly wait to catch my first glimpse of our beaming silver jet through the windows of our gate's waiting area, stride down the narrow jetway and through the jet's vault-like door, and sneak a peek into the cockpit as I filed past the flight crew, confident I'd be invited by the captain to return for a more thorough inspection later. Of course, I was most anxious to get up in the air so I could head back to the bathroom to try out the amazing vacuum toilet / bomb bay door for myself. From my friend's descriptions, I fully expected to be able to peer through the hole in the bottom of the toilet and see clear down to the ground to the unfortunate soul who'd soon be drenched with my plummeting pee. As it turned out, the experience didn't come close to meeting my high expectations. Sure, takeoff was exhilarating. The rumble of the jet engines, the powerful acceleration as we dashed down the runway, the rush of lifting off into the sky as the ground disappeared beneath us. But once we were airborne, things became distinctly more mundane. Rather than a lithe Julie Haggerty in go-go boots, My stewardess resembled a dowdy Ruth Buzzy in a polyester pantsuit. The fancy gourmet dinner I'd been told about turned out to be little more than a dressed-up TV dinner. Even the toilet failed to live up to the hype. Yes, when I pressed the lever to flush, it swallowed up my pee with a forceful sucking sound. But there was no hole in the bottom of the airplane. In fact, it was pretty obvious my pool of urine was simply dropping into a holding tank, rather than raining down onto some bewildered farmer's head. It was all very disappointing. Even worse, my invitation to visit the cockpit never arrived. In fact, the captain never once stepped out from behind the closed door at the plane's front. The only time we even heard his voice was when he announced we'd be beginning our descent. And even then it was almost entirely incomprehensible on the staticky overhead speaker. Clearly, he hadn't received word that there was a bright and charming 12-year-old boy sitting in coach, who was contemplating a future career in aviation. On the plus side, my sister did puke on our descent, proving she was just as adept at getting airsick as carsick. It provided me some measure of comfort to know some things would never change, no matter what the future held. At the very least, I confidently maintained that I'd be handed my own pair of shiny silver wings on my way off the plane, the same kind my friends had passed around during their presentations at school. But as I watched the passengers ahead of me filing out the door, I saw that the only things being distributed by the flight crew were obligatory smiles and thank yous. Not one to easily accept defeat, I stopped and caught the pilot's attention, making sure to employ the manners and 12-year-old charm that had always served me so well with adults. "Excuse me, Mr. Captain, sir, do you have any of those wing things I could have as a souvenir? This is my first time on an airplane." The captain's eyebrows sunk into a furrow. I'm not sure we're handing those out anymore," he replied. "Bill, have you seen a bag of badges?" he asked his co-pilot. The man shrugged his shoulders and wafted open his palms. "Sorry, I guess we ran out." So I walked off the plane with nothing. It seemed appropriate, considering the whole experience of flying had left me feeling empty inside. It just hadn't felt much like a family trip. There'd been no 3 a.m. wake-up, no sleepy march to the car, no glimpse of the Bong Recreation Area exit sign, no long naps on our car's sun-warmed rear window ledge, no license plate game, no helping Dad spot Smokies waiting with their radar guns at the side of the road. We hadn't fought over control of the car stereo. My father never levied a dad tax on our French fries. My parents hadn't argued about when it was time to get off the highway and refuel. We never once rolled into the parking lot of a Stuckey's or Ramada, or rushed around to scope out a motel's pool and game room, or started a single pillow fight on the precarious footing of a rollaway bed. It occurred to me that we'd barely even spoken to each other during the flight. I'd spent most of the time just staring out the window at the clouds, while on either side of me, my mother read her magazine and my sister slept in her seat. My father and brothers, seated in the row behind us, might as well have been on a different airplane. The only time I'd ever seen them was on my walk back to the bathroom. Through the miracle of modern aviation, we'd boarded a plane in Milwaukee, and in just 2 hours, about the time it normally took us just to clear the traffic of Chicago, had arrived in Washington, D.C., 800 miles away. Somehow, it didn't feel right. It felt as though we'd cheated. I wasn't sure who or what exactly. The travel gods? The great explorers who preceded us? Ferdinand Magellan, Lewis and Clark, Neil Armstrong? The plain fact was that other than purchasing our plane tickets, we'd made no real effort to reach our objective, as those men had, or even as we'd always had in the past. There'd been no hardships, no squabbles, no hours of tedium, not even a worry that we'd missed a turn and were suddenly headed for Walla Walla instead of the Washington Monument. Our flight had allowed us to soar over all the things that once made a family vacation. A family vacation. We'd taken a trip, but we'd made no journey. And somehow it felt as though we hadn't earned the right to enjoy our final destination. It would be untrue to say our family trip to Washington, D.C. wasn't a memorable one. It was. I still recall chasing my siblings up the twisting spiral of stairs inside the Washington Monument, walking the halls of the White House, and expecting to bump into President Reagan around every corner, and silently gazing up at the eternally contemplative face of Honest Abe at the Lincoln Memorial. There was also no doubt that the time and energy we'd saved by flying rather than driving allowed us to see and experience much more of the city. It had probably bought us the additional time we needed to visit the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, home of Charles Lindbergh's Spirit of St. Louis, and an Apollo command module identical to the one used in the lunar landing, as well as take a side trip to Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. But for me, without all of us together spending those long hours crammed in our car, bickering over whose foot had invaded whose personal space, and sweating out those long miles trying to make it to the next exit for gas, the trip would always stir mixed emotions. Perhaps it was because our visit to the nation's capital would also be among the last of our family vacations. As it turned out, the new era of air travel coincided almost perfectly with our final days traveling together as a family. It wouldn't just be jet-powered planes and cheap airfares that would kill our road trips together. It was the simple passage of time. We were all getting older, and life was quickly leading us in separate directions. By 1980, both of my brothers were at college out of state. My sister would follow in 1982. Until and including our trip to D.C., their holiday breaks happened to fall at just the right times to allow them to join the rest of us for our traditional family excursions. But that would soon change as, one by one, each went on to graduate, begin careers, and become increasingly entangled in the responsibilities that are part of growing up. When my brothers and sister could find time for a break, they reserved their precious vacation time to discover their own destinations, with friends rather than join my parents and me at some far more mundane vacation spot. Of course, that was a result of airline deregulation as well. Cheaper airfares to distant ports of call opened up a whole new world for the young and adventurous that hadn't existed before 1978. As for me, I would continue traveling with my parents throughout the decade, even after graduating from high school in 1987. After all, my folks were offering an all-expense-paid trip out of the Midwest winter to someplace warm. And as a poor high school and eventually college student, it wasn't as though my other options included a week-long junket in Waikiki. Sometimes my siblings would join us. Most often they wouldn't. Sometimes we'd drive, more often we'd fly. Not surprisingly, there quickly developed an inverse relationship between the number of family members choosing to tag along for the trip and the likelihood my dad would spring for plane tickets. And as we boarded each flight, I became ever more aware that our family trips had forever changed. It wasn't just because one or two of my siblings were so often missing. Something else was missing as well. Something we left behind in the airport parking garage each time we flew off into the horizon. Chapter 12. Leaving It All Behind. The End of the Road for Road Trips. One afternoon in late 1978, at almost exactly the same time President Carter was signing the Airline Deregulation Act into law, three musicians gathered in a London apartment for a songwriting session. Building on a catchy riff dreamed up by guitarist Bruce Woolley, musicians Trevor Horn and Jeff Downs spent an hour fleshing out a melody for the verses and adding a bridge, intro, and outro. Intent on creating a new sound, Horn, acting as producer, spent 6 months refining the track using the latest audio technology. He added a thumping dance beat, a bouncy bass line, and layer upon layer of shimmering synthesizer lines that Downs composed. The sound Horn concocted created an instantly appealing oral confection that thumbed its nose at the serious and self-indulgent guitar god rock dominating the airwaves of the day. As he was working his wizardry in the studio, Horn mulled lyrics that would match the song's vibrant new sound. Sensing that a new era was about to be born, not just in music but in modern culture, and that his innovative electronic sound could play a role, Horn ran with a novel idea. The lines he penned seemed trite and silly at first, but when they were sung, almost spoken, using an effect that made Horn's voice sound like that of a radio newsman from a bygone era, and placed against the backdrop of Horn's infectious synth-pop sound, the words took on new meaning. The lyrics both greeted the new age and eulogized the one that was fading. Horn titled the song, "Video Killed the Radio Star." Calling themselves the Buggles, Horn and Downs released the debut single in 1979, and it soon became a major international hit, topping the charts in 16 countries. "Video Killed the Radio Star" was among the first in a deluge of tracks produced by a new breed of avant-garde musical artists who became collectively known as the New Wave. The movement included such groundbreaking bands as Duran Duran, the B-52s, Culture Club, and Depeche Mode. Though these acts never quite dominated American music charts, their influence on pop culture far exceeded their modest record sales. It was this music that filmmakers of the early 80s chose as the backdrop for such hit movies as The Breakfast Club, Pretty in Pink, Weird Science, Top Gun, and Say Anything. In the process, new wave artists literally wrote the soundtrack for a generation. My generation. New wave's influence also ushered in sweeping new trends in art, fashion, and hairstyles. Suddenly in were skinny ties and spandex skirts, neon colors, the androgynous look, sport mullets for guys, big hair for women. Swatch watches, underwear as outerwear, and the exotic painted beauties of Patrick Nagel. Out were platform shoes, flared trousers, long stringy hairstyles for guys, the feathered Farrah look for women, and the psychedelic style of artists like Peter Max. Also falling out of favor were many of the music acts that had defined the 70s. Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, The Eagles, The Allman Brothers Band, The Bee Gees, Peter Frampton, Boston, Linda Ronstadt, James Taylor, Kansas, and The Doobie Brothers, among others, all struggled to remain relevant in the new decade. New Wave didn't kill them all, of course. Some disbanded due to internal turmoil or the deaths of key members. Some, like Van Halen, Fleetwood Mac, and Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, found ways to incorporate the synthesizer and aspects of the new wave sound into their music. Others just faded away because their time had passed. Nonetheless, the rise of new wave marked a significant changing of the guard. The times were indeed a changin', as the 70s gave way to the 80s. The feeling was palpable. It wasn't just the music. It was a cultural mindset. America had a new president in Ronald Reagan, a new sense of optimism, and within a very short time, new confidence in its rebounding economy. Americans were ready to dump the anxiety and malaise of the recent past and embrace a prosperous and exciting new future, one that included cheaper air travel made possible by airline deregulation. It seemed somehow appropriate then that just as my family was about to experience our first taste of that future, Video Killed the Radio Star resurfaced. On August 1st, 1981, 2 years after its initial release, the song and its music video launched the debut of MTV. Within months, my family, following in the footsteps of millions of other Americans, would board an airplane to embark on our first family vacation that didn't include a long trip by automobile. Just as MTV and its profound cultural influence would usurp the power of celebrity DJs and FM radio, the allure of inexpensive airfares and quick cross-country flights was about to bring the long reign of station wagons and triptychs to a close. Just as Video Killed the Radio Star, cheap air travel would snuff out the family road trip. The coup happened quickly. Between 1980 and 2000, the number of flights booked by Americans more than doubled, As early as 1990, just 12 years after President Carter had signed the Airline Deregulation Act, more adult Americans had flown than owned a car. In the blink of an eye, the world had changed. As the typical American family's choice of travel mode shifted, so did the vacation experience. Trips that once took days suddenly took hours. Parents no longer had to plan and prepare to keep the kids fed and satisfied on the road. Bags of cold sandwiches, thermoses of hot coffee, road atlases, toolkits bulging with replacement fuses and belts, planning for gas and potty stops, and the art of trunk packing all became relics of the past. Kids no longer had to steel themselves for endless hours in the back seat. Secret stashes of candy, portable electronic games, stacks of magazines and comics, invisible ink puzzles, magnetic beard games, and other diversions suddenly didn't hold nearly the same importance. Instead, everyone focused on the destination, wondering what the weather would feel like, planning what they'd do the moment they arrived. The journey became inconsequential, a brief nuisance to be endured until the fun could start. Where once a family trip began when the car pulled out of the driveway, now a vacation didn't really begin until the jet's wheels touched down on some distant runway. In fact, many travelers began thinking so little of the actual journey that they dressed for their destination before ever leaving home. In the middle of December in Wisconsin, families like mine could be seen dragging luggage into the airport, wearing nothing but shorts and t-shirts, their warm winter jackets left in their cars in the parking lot. It was as though they were already in Florida. But we were leaving behind much more than our bulky winter clothing. We were also leaving behind a quintessential American family experience. We were leaving behind all the curious sights and amazing views, the unexpected delights and unanticipated dangers, the colorful characters and unforgettable people who could only be encountered when traveling the highways of America. We were leaving behind so many of the ingredients that made family vacations truly memorable. That's not to say that the family road trip has entirely gone the way of the 8-track player or the fake wood-paneled station wagon. Road trips enjoyed a brief but robust renaissance in the wake of the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. While the threat of additional hijackings caused flights to be grounded across the nation for weeks, the attacks instilled a fear of flying in Americans that lasted far longer. What's more, the tragedy forced workaholic parents to take stock of their overscheduled lives. Many questioned why they were running themselves ragged to provide better lives for their kids when the extra income came at the expense of having no quality time to spend with them. Rather than canceling vacations, many families planned new ones. Only instead of taking to the skies, families once again took to the highways. For a while, many American families reacquainted themselves with the simple joys of heading out together on the open road. In an article published in the New York Times on November 11, 2001, just 2 months after the 9/11 attacks, writer Julia Chaplin deftly captured the country's mood. For years now, the pleasures of the road trip have palled. Driving long distances became a time-guzzling burden, and interstates seemed more often linked with road rage and bad French fries. But then came an overnight fear of air travel and a yearning for escape from new urban anxieties, especially in New York. Suddenly, the open road holds a fresh appeal for those who have single-mindedly pursued big city lives and ambitions. The revival would be short-lived. By 2004, the cost of oil had surged, boosting prices at the pump. At the same time, the absence of further hijackings reassured Americans that it was once again safe to fly. Gradually, American families returned to parking their cars and booking flights. By 2007, more Americans were flying than ever before. After a sharp decline due to the recession that began in 2008, the number of Americans traveling by air continues to rise steadily. Today, more than 750 million airline tickets are sold each year. Of course, the decision to drive rather than fly to distant destinations will likely always make sense financially, especially for larger families. As of this writing, the cost of a round-trip coach airline ticket from Milwaukee to Fort Lauderdale during spring break costs $342. For a family of six, like mine when I was growing up, that comes to $2,052. Include a mid-size rental car for an eight-day stay, and the cost swells another $750. That's $2,800 for transportation before laying out a single dollar for hotel, food, attractions, or other expenses. Now consider the cost to drive the same 2,902-mile distance in a minivan, which, when packed with six passengers and luggage, can struggle to achieve 22 miles per gallon. Using the current average gas price of $2.25 per gallon, that same trip would cost around $297. That's a difference of almost $2,500 in favor of driving versus flying. Without any pressure applied by my mom, I know what decision my dad would have made. Yet many families today choose otherwise. The reason is simple. The world has sped up since the 1970s. We live in an era of instant gratification, of instant text messaging, overnight package delivery, and movies on demand. When we want something, we want it now. At the same time, we spend our lives rushing to meet impossible deadlines, making ourselves available by phone and email around the clock, and putting in extra hours to get ahead in our careers. When we manage to work in a getaway, we want to make the most of it. For many of us, time has become far more precious than money, a priceless commodity not to be squandered lumbering along endless miles of highway and waiting in drive-through lines. We want to be there now, wherever the there is we're headed. We want to be on a beach under a hot sun, enjoying the view from the top of the Washington Monument, or taking smartphone snapshots of our kids with Mickey in front of the Princess Castle, right now. And until that teleporter from Star Trek is available, the quickest way to do that is by boarding an airplane. For those of us who do decide to drive, the experience of taking a long family road trip together isn't the same now. For one thing, families no longer really experience a long car ride together. In fact, for people sitting so close to one another, we've never been farther apart. In the back seats, where we as kids once sprawled out across our siblings or constantly changed seat positions depending on who was annoying whom, today each child must be rigidly buckled into his or her own child seat. Securely strapped into their padded cocoons, our kids can barely lift a sippy cup to their mouths, much less exchange noogies with their siblings. To keep them entertained, we put headphones on their ears and place tablet screens in front of their eyes, and allow each child to enjoy his or her own movie or game without even having to debate the choice with siblings. Meanwhile, in the front seat, Mom slips on her own headphones to retreat into her audiobook or podcast. Behind the wheel, Dad turns up the satellite radio and drifts off into his own private world, singing along to his favorite songs. Perhaps even the same 70s and 80s tunes he sang when he cruised the interstates with his parents. Largely gone are the days of family sing-alongs, playing the license plate game, or, God forbid, just talking to one another. At the same time, the country we live in has become far smaller. On today's interstates, it's difficult to travel more than a few dozen miles without passing an exit with a gas station and fast food restaurant, usually in the same building. Apps on our smartphones keep us updated regarding detours and traffic alerts, and ensure that roadside assistance is always just a phone call away. Today's cars have also become so reliable and worry-free that few of us even check our oil, much less pack a toolkit before departing on a long trip. Even if things do go wrong, safety features like advance warning alerts and run-flat tires allow drivers to travel for miles to find help. Yet those of us a certain age will recall that it wasn't so long ago that beginning a family road trip felt a lot like setting off into the wild frontier. True, the roads were paved and the route was marked, and we were unlikely to encounter any bears or bands of outlaws. But the journey ahead was still fraught with unknown perils. Before us lay hundreds of miles of open road, and anything could happen. We might run out of gas along a lonely stretch of interstate, on a rainy night in Arkansas. We might take a shortcut, only to find ourselves being chased by a pack of wild dogs on a back road in Louisiana. Or we could be turned away from a full motel after a long day's drive. The next motel with vacancy, still hours of dark highway down the road. And when things did go wrong, we'd be on our own. On our own, but together, as a family, ready to face whatever the coming miles and passing hours brought our way. More than anything else, that's what made a family road trip so special. The feeling of being inextricably bound together in a great adventure. An adventure based less on where we were headed, and more in the moments we shared along the way. In the end, it never really mattered where we traveled in our car on all those great family road trips. In simply making the drive together, we were already in the best place of all. Don't Make Me Pull Over, an informal history of the family road trip, was written by Richard Rattay and read by Jonathan Todd Ross. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Don't Make Me Pull Over, an informal history of the family road trip, is available in print from Scribner.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.